The river is flowing through this place, O God, and has been and shall be. We are grateful for the gift of life. We are grateful for the gifts of life, such as peace and justice and righteousness, and today for forgiveness. Let us be washed, and let us be ready to wash others. Amen.
Amen.
So, we have this theme, where the river flows, life abounds, and we've been defining life by the qualities of grace that God grants. And if you might recall, at the very beginning, we had that picture of a total harmony, of a harmony between God and humans, among humans, between humans and the rest of creation. That's the image, really, of the Garden of Eden. It's also an image of some promises in Isaiah, for example, about the lamb lying down with the lion and the children playing with the snakes. The lamb and the lion, of course, would imply that the lion is no longer a carnivore. So that's an expression of this harmony that is a promise of what is to come. But we could also take that as a statement of what God desires and of what God's intent is. So part of that has to be this issue of forgiveness. We're going to hear two versions of that. The first is the simple one, purge me with hyssop and I shall be clean, wash me and I shall be whiter than snow. But we just saw another one. You want to read that for us?
Sure. Soak me in your laundry and I'll come out clean. Scrub me and I'll have a snow white life. Tune me into foot tapping songs. Set these once broken bones to dancing. Don't look too close for blemishes. Give me a clean bill of health. God, make a fresh start in me. Shape a Genesis week from the chaos of my life. Don't throw me out with the trash.
And notice, you know, make a fresh start. So that's one of the questions about this whole concept. What are the consequences? What does it mean to be whiter than snow? How do we understand forgiveness? And what are the consequences for the one forgiving as well as for the one being forgiven? And we'll get to a quote from Bonhoeffer afterwards, but first I'd like to have you do our morning practice now to talk about this. What does it mean to be whiter than snow? And then ask the question, what are the consequences for the one forgiving and for the one being forgiven? A question? Or were you?
I'm singling a friend.
Oh, good.
I'm trying to come over here, excuse me. But I can tell you what it means to be whiter than snow.
Yeah.
When you're ready.
Okay. 10 minutes as usual. Go at it. The point with Bonhoeffer is that Bonhoeffer talked about forgiveness not being a matter of accounting, but rather a matter of relationships. That the person doing the forgiving says, I will not allow your behavior to become a barrier in our relationship to each other. He also said that forgiveness that is meaningful is participatory. That the one doing the forgiving participates in the consequences of the behavior of the other. And some people, including Eberhard Bethge, who was his close friend and who is the one that received all the letters from Bonhoeffer during Bonhoeffer's imprisonment. In English, the title is Letters and Papers from Prison. Bethge said that that even though Bonhoeffer never said it in particular, he talked about participatory forgiveness, and if you assume that's reflective of his own behavior, he wrote a little piece called "I Loved This People," talking about his love for the German people and the pain of not just that Hitler took over, but the pain that he felt for the sake of all the people, both that they were part of the Nazi period, they took part in it, they were active, but secondly, that they also were destroyed by it. And he thought it was necessary to stop the forces that were causing that, and therefore he participated in the plot on Hitler's life, not thinking that was heroic. Rather, that was evil. Murder is murder. And he was willing to become guilty of murder as a way of saying to the people, I forgive you and I liberate you from the evil that has taken over our folk. So he had a very particular understanding that forgiveness is relational, not an accounting matter. We've got all these sins and we've got to check them off. But rather, it's relational and it's participatory. Now, before we go on, just two little things. If you want to hear German in its almost purest form, you have a chance. Anna here is she's doing her work. She's on the staff, and she is stripping blossoms of
seeds of
lavender today. Anna is from an area of Bavaria that's wet on the western portion of Bavaria, close to an area called Swabia. But her German is absolutely pure and neutral in its pronunciation, and also in the formal form. She speaks absolutely formal German with no hint of any dialect, even though Augsburg is in the middle of two of the strongest, could we say that? Two of the strongest dialects of Germany. The Bavarian dialect, that's a sharp dialect, has lots of influences from Italy with the rolling R's, and the Swabian dialect that's looked upon by many as kind of a
hillbilly
dialect. And she comes from right in the middle of that area. She could be, Augsburg, you could almost go either way, couldn't you? You have some Schwabish flavor to the Bavarian. But if you want to hear some beautiful, pure German, get in conversation with her. Secondly, I didn't want to take time this morning with the whole group at breakfast, but some of you may have noticed that the way we sang that canon was not the way we sing it, where if you have, in this case, there were two voices, that each voice sings to the end of the verse. So at the end, you have the one group kind of trailing off, but rather we stop in the middle and had a... had a chord. We did two parts. The one song only would have two chords no matter how you divided it, but the first song could be a complete key of C chord. I'm going to have you divided 1, 2, 3, 4, and I'll sing through that, and when I get to the end of a phrase, I'll ask you to hold that note. And just keep humming it out loud, and then you hum the next one, and the last one, and we'll have a complete chord. Vom Aufgang der Sonne, hold that bum bum, let's hear it bum bum, bis zu ihrem Niedergang, bum, auf dem Lower bum bum, sei gelobet der Name des Herrn, bum bum bum, sei gelobet der Name des Herrn, bum 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 bum. So it would be possible to sing that as a canon in four parts, and then end when the last part would start its first phrase, and then we'd have that full, the full C major chord. Just a little bit of
participatory.
Yeah. Yes. So, in 1964, for the first time since the wall went up in 1961, but it wasn't just the wall in Berlin, the whole border between East and West had been strengthened. But in 1964, the East German government allowed people from the East to visit the West, but only through Bahnhof Zoo. That was, at that time, the central railway station in West Berlin. And certain groups of people could visit without having any special visas. All they had to do was show up. Those groups were seniors getting support from the state, and also you might remember clear back in 1870 Bismarck started Social Security for the German states, and that was continuing, of course, in both West and East Germany. So pensioners in the East could go to the West and visit relatives, or just go to West Berlin for a few days during the season of Advent prior to Christmas of 64. And also people with disabilities who were dependent on the state. So people who could go to the West and then not return were allowed to go, and they didn't mind if those people did not return because they were costing the East, the government, money. Otherwise, hardly anybody, it was very difficult to get an exit visa for a visit out of the German Democratic Republic. I was at a variety of meetings from 76 till 85 in Sweden, in Germany, in Switzerland, in France, in Africa, and in Hungary. And at these meetings, a journalist from the church journal of the state of Saxony, called The Sunday, that's the name of the journal. We get it all the time, and it sits around until Cam says, "Paul, have you read it yet?" But there was a journalist for Der Sonntag. It's interesting that in German, you know, you decline nouns, and it's not normally you'd say für den Sonntag, but when it's a title, you don't decline that. So it's für der Sonntag. Okay? That's just a little bit of grammar in case you speak German. So. He was a reporter for Der Sonntag, this journal meaning Sunday, and he went to everything. And some of us wondered how it was that the church, which was, as we've been saying, which was really restricted by the state in many ways, how a church journal that was not flush with funds could have this reporter go all over Europe and also down to Africa for meetings. And I noticed that he was always asking questions. And if after a session, some of us would gather someplace for a glass of wine or a beer, he was listening and asking. He didn't talk much, but he was always listening and asking. And I assumed that he was an informer. That was kind of an automatic way of dealing with some of those people. That if there was a person where it was unlikely that person would have the freedom to get out and back and out and back, and especially if that person was full of questions you just assume here's an informer on our hands. The same is true, there was an engineer, he was the chief engineer for the waterworks of the city of Dresden. Well, in the first place, how does a person who is active in the church get a job like that? Typically, the Christians weren't allowed to have those jobs. And then once again, he had a family there, but how did he get to come to all these meetings representing the church? And he was a very gregarious fellow, so he was always mixing with everybody, and several of us assumed also with him that he was an informer. And then some of you were here the day I talked about Olaf. Christian Kreuzel is the head of their version of Lutheran Social Services for the region around Leipzig. He had been, he also is a pastor now, he had been an active member of a church youth group in a small city close to the Czech border. And in this small city where the kids knew most of the other kids, there was one fellow named Olaf who was always in trouble. And one time, one Sunday evening, they were having their youth group gathered at the church, and Olaf showed up and said, "I am supposed to get converted. How do I do that?" So they all assumed, just like some of us assumed with the journalist and the engineer, they all assumed, aha, Olaf got into trouble one time too many and had the choice, go to jail or become an informer with that youth group at church. So he showed up. Now the youth group had been doing things that bordered on being illegal or were illegal. Whenever they would meet with a foreigner, for example, they were supposed to in advance register with the Communist Party and get permission for that. But rather often groups from church youth groups from Sweden or from Finland, Scandinavia in general, but especially Sweden and Finland would go through. And they had been meeting with them. They had a meeting about peace. The Christian youth would talk about peace, Swedish and East German, but they didn't register in advance. Olaf was part of that meeting. What the youth did was to welcome Olaf in, assuming he was an informer, but they kept doing all the things they had done. They didn't change anything. They didn't stop doing anything. And they included Olaf in everything. Well, in June of 2011, Christian Kreuzel came over for the farewell, the retirement farewell of the head of LSS of Minnesota for 25 or 30 years. And he and his wife said they'd like to stay longer and be guests in Minneapolis, but they had to go back because there was a big anniversary celebration in Christian's home congregation. And he said, Olaf, of course, will be there. Olaf has been active in the church his whole life. He's even served in the church council. And Christian has this wonderful story of his hard decision about the files. Now, you remember, you've been hearing about the Stasi files, the files of the state secret police. After a few years, I recall when it was, I think it was 1996, but it might have, that's just in my memory. The files became available. And by the way, how many of you have seen the film Lives of Others? Yeah, well, that's a dramatic film that talks about how insidious this whole system was of getting informers. And it's easy to think all the informers are bad people. And yet, the system was so insidious in trapping people and saying this or that you've heard me too many times this week, those who've been here talk about the medication. You know, your wife needs some medication for her fatal illness, perhaps. And we'll get that for you if you become an informer. With the reality, of course, she won't get that if you don't become an informer for us. So it's a rather complex thing. How do you deal with people who were informing on you? And Christian Kreuzel decided he didn't want to know who the informers were. So he didn't go to his file. And then gradually he decided, if I'm serious about being forgiving, if I'm serious about being gracious, then I have to know whom I'm forgiving and do it in reality. So he finally went to his file. Nothing new. The people he anticipated were informers. And there was nobody there that was a surprise for him. He had a rather large file, actually, but the biggest portion of the file were the notes, the reports from Olaf. So, of course, he was curious. What would he find in Olaf's reports? There were some things in there that Olaf had made up that were just nonsense. There were some things there that were accurate reports of what they had done that were boring and didn't mean anything. But of the things that could have caused trouble, there was no word. Olaf got converted. They received him. And in a sense, see, he came in as an informer, and they all knew that he could, in a sense, send them to jail, or the pastor to jail, by what he would tell them. They refused to change, but they welcomed him, and he was changed. So in his reports, there was nothing about the meeting with the Swedes, nothing about conversations of how do we protest, how do we participate in the peace movement, nothing like that, but rather a bunch of gobbledygook that didn't mean anything. And in the end, he got baptized, he got confirmed, and has spent his life as an active member of the congregation. So we have this this gift of grace, and sometimes it's hard to know when has forgiveness taken place, or how has it taken place. And surely often we don't pay attention to the consequences of grace. And we, in our own context, of course, now especially when our whole nation is divided, our culture is divided, our congregations are divided, we perhaps have some things to learn about forgiveness and grace and relationship and the participation that we mentioned from Bonhoeffer. Now, you recall we started with a verse out of Matthew 5. Remember what that was? God causes rain to fall on the righteous and the unrighteous. So in a sense, we move full circle. We're back to grace, that God causes the rain to fall even on the unrighteous, because they are also part of creation. And God's desire is that in all of creation there would be harmony. And God practices that harmony. So, once again, the nature of the program in the ELCA of the Companion Synod is not that one group will copy the other, but that we would learn from each other, and that in learning from each other and about each other, we each would perhaps be changed for our own context. And you might recall that clear back in 1971, the Eastern Church said, our context is a communist dictatorship. Now, what do we do about it? How do we be faithful in this context? And they decided they would be faithful by being a church for others. They would take risk for the sake of their society, for the sake of improving the lives, of loving and caring, and ultimately it developed that the task for others, when they were sitting there between the rockets of NATO and the rockets of the Warsaw Pact, with Soviet tanks surrounding them, that one way that they could be a church for others was to be a church of peace, led to the peace prayers, led to the demonstrations, and even if the government of East Germany would have fallen anyway, many, many people say the reason it fell peacefully was because of the action of the church. And in the end, I think that statement by the communist official is something that should give us courage. If righteousness is flowing in the stream of life, sometimes not flowing through our own doing, but is flowing, it's that statement that we, the government of the East, backed by the armies of the Soviet armies, we were prepared for everything, just not candles and prayers. So, we have quite a lot. We have 20 minutes left. Wrap up now. Yes.
You mentioned the lives of others, and in that film, contrary to the story that you told about Olaf, there was real harm done. There was a death. There was a horrible. But it, and what happened there, where the forgiveness, where things turned, is it took some time for the protagonist to figure out that the Stasi person had actually tried to mitigate the damage at one point. But it took a long time. Years passed. And he tried to reconnect with this Stasi officer. And out of his own pain, having lost his partner, but also out of his God-given talent, he reached out and, without really having much dialogue, he wrote a book, and the Stasi officer realized that it was about him. But it took time, it took everything that God gave each of them to get to that point.
And that's critical in two parts. One is to know that there was real damage done, of course, and it's ongoing. And the relationships that we talk about, forgiveness is relational. Similar relationships were too broken to be mended. And it's still going on in the church. Should someone who was an informer and provided the destructive information be allowed to remain as a pastor in the church, or be elected as a superintendent of an area, or be elected to serve politically in the government? Those are hard questions. But also, it was critical what you said, that the Stasi officer had acted, even though he was doing what Stasi officers did, he had acted in a way to mitigate the destruction. And I tend to read into things God's active grace. And I would say that's an example of what we talked about a few days ago, about the righteousness flowing. From where does that righteousness come? It doesn't have to come from people of faith. It can also come simply from life. And that is God's gift. And so I would say the fact that people who do not believe function with, not just with tolerance, but with compassion, Elizabeth, you talk about a study where one person said that that people of faith tend as a group to be less compassionate than people of no faith, because we have more rules. You shouldn't do this, and shouldn't do that, and shouldn't do that. And if you're doing it, you're not worthy of compassion. That's kind of a practice, and not just Christian, it's Jewish or Christian or Muslim or others. So we have some work to do there, but I would say when it does happen, when a person who is not of faith is compassionate, that's in my understanding of God is the God of creation and the God of justice and the God of righteousness and the God of compassion. And God provides that river flowing with those things, whether it's coming through the church or through the synagogue or not. That's the nature of God. Yeah.
I was struck by this Olaf story is that in essence, forgiveness was given before the action.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, they forgave him by welcoming him.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. And that's where the forgiveness did change him. Mm-hmm. But the grace of the relationship that they welcomed him as one of them. They established their relationship, and that changed them. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I'd be interested in your thoughts about the relationship of forgiveness to the process in South Africa that Bishop Tutu led, which I think the word they used is reconciliation.
Sure.
And the circumstances, of course, were somewhat different, but still an enormous amount of brutality and damage. What is the relationship of forgiveness and reconciliation, if there is a difference or comparison?
Well, all I can do is give you my thoughts thoughts on that.
Sure.
But I would say that reconciliation is conceal. A conceal is a body of people together. To reconcile means to reform the relationship. So we're back to Bonhoeffer's understanding that forgiveness is not accounting, but it's relational. And forgiveness means that despite what you white people did to us blacks, and despite what we tried to do to you, now we are one nation and we belong to each other. So I see that as what forgiveness is about. It's about reestablishing relationships despite the behavior of one side or the other or both. And the trouble is, of course, it's really hard and not necessarily always successful. And sometimes it takes a long time, such as in the film, and by the time it happens, a lot of destruction may have occurred. What else do some of the rest of you think about that? One, two, yes.
Well, mine's a little different, but we had an exchange with some Russian teachers, and when I was in Moscow, I was invited to her house, and we had German food for dinner. And I asked about why the German, and she said her father was Soviet military, her mother was a doctor, and they were housed when they were in East Germany. And this woman had no choice. She just had to have this couple. And after a few days, she said to Lena's mother, "You are a terrible cook." And she taught her how to cook, even though they were forcibly housed in there.
Yeah.
So I guess that's a form of forgiveness and building a relationship.
Which reminds me, by the way, of 1972, we moved from a little tiny South Dakota town of 700.
Yeah, if you count the dogs.
to a small city in southern Germany, and I was one of five pastors in a congregation of 15,000. One of three pastors we had two churches. It was one parish, two churches, and I was in this one, three pastors. I had nearly 4,000 people. I had the largest district of that group. Pastors had pastoral districts or parochial districts. And in the district where I was a pastor, there had been an American POW camp following the war. Plus, a dear woman, Frau Lele, lived in the house next to us. It was the house that her parents had built, and she was raised in that house. And her, she was engaged to be married, and her fiancé was killed in the war. That
first
is the
world.
First World War. And she decided she had promised to be faithful. So she stayed single and in her mind engaged to her loved one who had fallen in the First World War. Second World War came, her parents by then had died and she was alone in this house. War came to an end. During that war, 7,000 out of the 49,000 residents had been killed in half hours worth of bombing by the Brits. The Americans had that POW camp up the hill from her. And she was, what was she?
Making marmalade.
She was making marmalade in her kitchen, knock on the door, an American officer said, "You must get out, we are taking your house." And she couldn't finish her marmalade. She had to grab something to wear, put it in the bag, and leave the house. And then I had to be her pastor in America. But those are things that they have just learned to live with. And she, dear Frau Lele, she couldn't control her hands. She heard people, she knew that the name was Rogers, but in Swabia, S as a plural, is never a part of a last name. So Rogers wouldn't be possible. She also knew that it was spelled R-O-G, which is good. And she heard people say J. So I was help Faha Rochka. She got both sounds in there. She heard people say J, but she knew G is what G means. So I was help Faha Rochka. And she, on a regular basis, would come over to our house carrying a pound cake to offer us to enjoy the pound cake. So, stories. Someone else had a hand up over here.
I just was going to comment on the process of reconciliation in South Africa. In terms of forgiveness, because that's what we're looking at, that I don't know emotionally how they were reconciled, but a big part of the process was just naming what had happened. And often for me, forgiveness doesn't happen because we keep secret the hurt, the pain, and we nourish that internally. But in that reconciliation, they had a significant protocol by which both those who hurt and were hurt could come together and they could declare publicly all that had happened. And that was a huge part of moving towards forgiveness.
Yeah.
Yeah. Staying on that, it's an oblique question, but wasn't that the truth and reconciliation?
It was.
Yes.
And if it was administered, where did truth, the word truth, come from in that process? Was it a political gift? Was it a religious gift? Was it a compromise gift? But truth, I mean, we've been in this whole truth thing this week.
I don't know, but I think the truth was the naming.
The name.
Yeah, but first we named
somebody named it truth.
Yeah, but
Desmond
we named the
Tutu
thing.
Desmond Tutu had a big role in that.
Pardon?
Desmond Tutu.
Yeah, I think he did have a big role in that, but I don't know who designed that, but it seems to me the truth applies to the naming of the evil that was done, or the pain that was caused.
I just wondered where the source of truth was.
It was Desmond Tutu.
Was it Tutu?
I think so.
So then that was a Christian source, with all of what you've been saying.
Yeah.
It's part of a lot of faiths, actually. Naming, being able to name something lessens its power over you. and makes you less a victim, more vulnerable to it.
I would like to ask, as kind of a review, what in this week has been for you, for one thing, most surprising? What's something that you just hadn't been aware of? And perhaps what has been most important or moving, and what has been most challenging? Any of those three, surprising, moving, or challenging from this week? Yes.
I think the realization that it is so important to listen and to try to internalize the role of the East Germans to contribute to the growth of the West Germans, which I had always assumed that the West Germans helped the East. Well, the East had experiences which West Germany had yet to go through. And that was a revelation.
And that, unfortunately, has been a very small movement, but it has been part of it in the church. But unfortunately, to a greater degree, the West said, "We know how to do church, so join us now."
But I think there's a lesson in that for us, is that we have more to learn from the third world than the third world has to learn from us.
Absolutely.
Oh, yeah. So, anything else?
We talked about this a little bit one of the early days of your presentation, but it seems to me that the story of the East German Church, you know, it's easy to put it into sort of heroic proportions and make it far from our experience. But maybe we could think about the ways in which the culture that we live in is not Christian, is kind of alien to Christian values, and the fact that we are providing answers to questions people aren't asking anymore, and our congregations are shrinking, and we are actually becoming more like that church in East Germany than we maybe realize. And there will be coming a time, I'm guessing, that we will need to take more than one lesson from them, or that they might be able to help us.
Over and over again, I've had people righteously, self-righteously talk about how in Europe nobody goes to church. In Minneapolis, we've got contacts outside of the church, and I've noticed that among people below 40, perhaps, when they learn that I'm a retired pastor, they look on me as kind of quaint. The whole concept of religious faith is foreign to them. And it's hard to know what data to believe. But I believe most would say that 50% of our nation belongs to some religious organization. It's not just Christian, but in a formal way, 50% belong to a religious community. In most cases, among Protestants and Catholics these days, of the members, 20% are regular in worship, in gathering as a faith community. That means 20% of 50%. Huh? So we're down to 10% of the population. And many of us think that regular worship attendance, in many cases for us, has been as culturally determined as anything. When we start to ask questions of what we really believe, for example, a woman that we know really well was married to a Lutheran pastor for a while, She never goes to worship, but she considers herself a Christian, and recently was talking about, well, when after she dies, she wonders what she will come back as, and asked me what I think I'm going to be when I come back. I said, well, we don't believe that. What? You don't believe that? She wasn't aware that that isn't part of our teaching, that reincarnation as another, as an animal or whatever. She doesn't even know that. So many of us would say, of the 20% of our membership who come on a relatively regular basis, maybe half of them are really committed. So that was 20% of 50. And 50% of that 20 means that maybe 5% of our population is knowledgeable and committed in their faith. And that isn't a whole lot different from Europe. Most data from Europe talk about 3 to 5%. So when we're feeling boastful about all the people in church, I think we have to be a little humble and remind ourselves that we really are in a society that's not a whole lot different. In East Germany, it's 15%, and they don't have full churches either. But even now, after the change, the 15% in general represent a pretty conscious commitment of faith. And the fact that they had gone through what they went through for those 4 years would indicate that that was attested to. Not to make them heroes, but rather to make ourselves a little humble.
It's really interesting about that, Paul, is that that's, that data that you just sort of shared is pretty similar to the data about informed voters.
Yeah. Well, what did I say? Surprises, challenges, moving things. What other? What I'm wondering is if in some other setting I do this kind of a thing again, what are some of the things that I should be aware of? Yes.
Well, I don't know if it's exactly in that direction, but I'm relating to what the gentleman said about the percentage of informed voters. I have a very pragmatic approach, and I'm looking for ways. The gridlock in Congress, for instance, is an outgrowth of a lot of division in our country. And this process that we've been examining here, and the forgiveness process and reconciliation, and we have the strength of the church organizations and people of faith. What can we do to help our own folk with the divisions that we're experiencing right now? These are not only political, but of course philosophical, and in some cases spiritual. That's a rather big subject.
Yeah.
In 2 minutes.
That's hard to read, Paul.
This is oikomene, yeah? Which is the word for ecumenical. But it starts with this word, oikos, which is the house. And some of us say that I was on an advisory group for the Minnesota Council of Churches, which is still a very active state council of churches, and I proposed that we change the focus, that we start to talk about differing positions rather than official denominations, and that we have to practice oikumene in our own oikos. That inside of our own house, within our own denominations, we have to find ways of the different groups to talk to each other. That's where we start being ecumenical, is among the groups that disagree and sometimes are mutually condemnatory. But I would agree that we need some work, but we the first place we would have to start as churches is not to tell the nation how to do it, but first learn how to do it ourselves.
Yeah. So, Paul, for me, the moving part is the stories. It started with you at the Village Center talking about stories. And then in all these sessions, you've brought stories, and that's been very moving and incredible. So I encourage you to do that. That's a very
so you'd say one. These are stories that maybe are worth telling.
Yes, definitely.
The politest gentleman in the world is in the back.
Yeah.
No, I've appreciated how you've challenged us to relate the East German stories to our own context, and reminded of Bonhoeffer, who in an ecumenical conference said that peace is the opposite of security. And I think that's one place where we might ask in our own context about how we are invested in security, what we are most concerned about protecting ourselves from, and how there are many stories that could be told, like Olaf's, of except primarily in Muslim settings, where we have, our like the FBI has informants in mosques, particularly planting the ideas of would you consider this terrorist activity and see if anyone bites. I'd encourage you. There's a good This American Life story on that theme, where some of the folks that were being spied on essentially said, we're really cautious now about any potential converts particularly from a European background, because we're afraid that they may be informants on us, that they may be more spies in our midst than not genuine converts. So that kind of thing does go on in our own land.
Yeah.
What's moving to me is that the stories in the context of quotes from the Bible, because it makes the Bible living, instead of, oh, this is mythical stuff that happened a long time ago, or that's nice stuff, but it means peace. These are beautiful examples of the living, the Bible in action.
Thanks, and that reminds me that I had wanted to say also that maybe you folks noticed that of the five quotes, four of them are Old Testament. And we in the Christian church have a tendency to say that all those Old Testament quotes are really about Jesus, as if they had no authenticity at the time, but that they didn't gain authenticity until Jesus showed up. But it's the other way around, that the early church recognized, and Jesus' preaching and his ministry, recognized that Jesus was about what God had been saying all along, so that there's an absolute independent validity for all of those things. And we of Christian faith would say it has become most radically revealed and evident in this mystery of the incarnation, but it is the Word of God that always was the Word of God, and the desire of God that always was the desire of God. And over again, when we define who Jesus was, or what the ministry of Jesus was, or what their promises are, over and over again, those are Old Testament promises that we have taken. And for me personally, I tend to see them not as a change, that Jesus didn't change anything, but rather Jesus was a radical revelation of the divine reality that always has been.
Yeah, he didn't come to repeal the law, he came to fulfill it.
And I would say, and fulfill the promises, but they still aren't fulfilled. Yes?
The emphasis on stories rings, because that's the way Jesus taught. He taught through stories. And then we formerly were members of the Episcopal Church in Minnesota, and we get their website come to our home. And the emphasis right now is telling stories. And these are on that website, and there are stories of people who live in Minnesota, predominantly, I believe.
Thanks for that. I was hoping, one final thing, we've got, oh, we're late, sorry. We've got minus 6 minutes. I had wanted to encourage you to be observing when you go home. Rather than taking these stories as models, rather that you would go home and observe and listen and see what stories you're finding in your own communities that are stories of context, of knowing this is where we are, these are the needs, of being in this nation with its issues, stories of peace, of justice and righteousness. If you recall, righteousness is on the road of doing righteousness. Stories of order, order as something that provides the opportunity for justice and peace sometimes. And finally, stories of grace and forgiveness. So become collectors. I encourage you to become collectors of your own community's stories. Sorry to keep you late. Thanks.